Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring.
Yesterday evening, the news came through that Joe Biden, the former US president, had been diagnosed with an aggressive form of prostate cancer, a cancer that is, according to those reports, already in his bones, and that they were looking at treatment options for him. John Wall, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
Very well, John. Now, John, we have to go back to 2017 when you got your diagnosis. Remind us, what were you told at that time?
Yeah, at that time, aged 47, I was told that I had a very aggressive form of prostate cancer. It was stage four. I was told it was terminal. I was told that palliative chemotherapy was what was on offer. And little hope, I guess, for what lay ahead in my life. But thankfully, nothing could have been further from the truth. Well, it was true at that point in time, but thankfully, the treatment options that ensued have worked for me to the point now where I'm talking to you, completely healthy, living a normal life, and I'm living with a stage four diagnosis. I used to say dying from. I'm absolutely not. I'm just something I'm living with. And I suppose one of the purposes of this conversation is in relation to President Biden's diagnosis over the last few days, that many others find themselves in similar situations, and about health in general, but in relation to prostate cancer. It's something also at that age that you can die with and not die from. And I'm sure that President Biden will have all the treatment options out there available, that they will also be made available to him. But it's something that there's been significant advances in terms of treatment options, even since my own diagnosis. Now, I had to go, I had a combination of treatment at home and abroad. And yes, there was curative intent there, but I was being looked at as a very young man to have what I had. I had primary prostate and secondary in my lymph nodes. And whilst, you know, there's been significant side effects to treatment, the main thing is that I'm alive and well, and very well, and here to tell the tale.
And John, I mean, it's brilliant to talk to you, and congratulations to be still with us and still talking to us. But if we go back to that diagnosis, I think for all of us, you know, to sit in a doctor's surgery and hear those news, particularly when you hear the word stage four, it is everybody's greatest nightmare, really, I think. What was your initial response to that? How did you react to it initially?
I didn't listen. I shut out. I thought I heard something, but I wasn't sure. I questioned it. Is that what was really said? And it took a couple of weeks for it actually to sink in. And when it did, complete numbness, because your whole life, literally, and that of your loved ones, it just flies right in front of your eyes. And you go into a state of self-preservation and wondering, you know, what's going to happen next. Now everything is in everyone else's hands. You're being told what to do, where to go, treatment options, and you're at the behest of others. It's a very strange place to be, and it all happens so quickly. With an advanced diagnosis, you go from one point in your life to the extreme in a matter of days. But it's something, I guess, that I was fortunate enough to be able to, and with the help of others, to deal with at the time, to acknowledge and say, okay, take a step back and say, what can we do to ensure the best possible outcome here? We got opinions, we got second opinions, we got third opinions, and eventually the decisions that were taken ended up being the correct ones. Great thing. The benefit of hindsight is a great thing, but they did. They helped me. And the point of this as well is to offer hope to others, because there was a point in my life when I had absolutely no hope. I was preparing for the worst. I had myself mentally prepared to die. And one of the hardest parts of not dying is living. Because when you mentally prepare for something and it doesn't happen, you have to reverse engineer everything in your own brain. And then you have your whole life, which I have now, my whole life ahead of me. And you have to readjust again. But this time round, having gotten a second chance, this time round, I cherish every single second of it. I have my moments, you know, I'm a positive person, but I acknowledge those down moments as well, because as I said, there have been side effects to the surgery and the treatment. But everything has made me the person that I am and enjoy the life that I live and look forward to each and every day. And I can look forward now to a long, happy, healthy life ahead.
And going back to that, because as you say, you had come to terms with it, you had brought yourself to a place where you could you could accept that was it. Your life was going to be cut short. Like at that point, did you take steps to put your affairs in order? Like, were you at that level of acceptance in terms of where you had to bring yourself back from?
Ironically, yeah, that exact phrase was mentioned to me to get my affairs in order. I went to one particular surgeon for an opinion, and he said, my advice to you is to get your affairs in order. And this was get my affairs in order. And this was a particular surgeon that I was placing a lot of hope in that was going to prolong my life. It didn't happen. And then you're in that space in your mind to get your affairs in order. But everything happened so quickly around you, in that because I wasn't able to have that surgery, I explored another option, and one other option ended up that I went abroad. And after chemotherapy, there's only a relatively small window within which to operate. So decisions had to be made very, very quickly. And then that led to me going to the University Hospital Leuven in Belgium for surgery, and then came back home for radiation treatment and subsequent hormone treatment, which I actually voluntarily came off about two and a half years ago, to the point now where I'm on no treatment at all. I have regular checkups every 3 months, and I'm quite happy to say that I go in, I tell them how I'm feeling, and I walk back out again. There's nothing to tell. I feel absolutely fine.
Is there still a shadow there, you know, on your peripheral vision almost, you know, that you have to have these regular checkups and that you might hear something at those? No, is that gone
now? Not anymore, Katie. No, it's gone. Now, there was a point in time, yes, you're always looking over your shoulder, but for some time now, absolutely not. I'm just a normal guy living a normal life. I've got a second chance. I've been given a second chance, and I'd love to know what that magic formula is, because there's so many people out there that don't have as an aggressive a diagnosis, but end up unfortunately succumbing to the disease. And there are others like myself then that are giving a terrible diagnosis, and you end up overcoming it. And you'd love to know what that ingredient is. I suppose all we can do is, those of us that want to, is share our stories, tell people how we cope, how we live, and how we deal with what has happened in our lives, and hope that gives, I suppose, a little bit of inspiration and hope to others that are going through similar, but not just the patients themselves, but their families and their friends, because it involves all of us. And ultimately, we all know someone going through, a diagnosis, a difficult diagnosis. And I think the more we talk about things, the more we foster conversations, the more we normalize conversations, well, the more it helps us all to understand what's going on, and it makes it it makes it easier to deal with for all of us.
Did you find, and obviously, John, you're a very open kind of guy. You obviously have, you know, no problem discussing this and have been discussing this for years now. Mm-hmm. Did you find that other people found it difficult to go there with you? That some people find the whole cancer conversation, if I can put it like that?
Yeah, initially, yes. Hard, yeah. It used to be called, when I was growing up, it was the Big C. Yeah. And you heard about it, but you didn't talk too much about it because it was a very difficult conversation. You don't want to upset anybody. But the more we talk about it, again, we go back to normalizing a conversation. Not flippantly, but I liken it to the common, just a cold, in that it's just something that's happening. And if we don't talk about it, we can't ever hope for others to understand what it's all about, how we get through it, and indeed, the medical community. The more we talk, the more they understand. I suppose I'm one of those unique people in terms of the age that I was diagnosed at. So the medical community are looking at me and say, "How did this happen? You shouldn't be this good, but I am." So when I go in every 3 months. The last conversation I had with my oncologist said, "You're continuing to defy." I said, "I know. and it's a great place to be. But they want to know why. I would love to be able to tell them. All I can do is share what I'm thinking, how I'm coping, how we're dealing. Any aches and pains, thankfully, there's not. Any niggles, which there's not. But that openness will, I suppose, ensure that invariably others will be helped into the future.
I mean, I understand, like, because we've been hearing about the Gleason score in relation to President Biden, that his was 9.
Yeah.
Which it's a 1 to 10 scale, 1 being the least aggressive, I suppose, and 10 being the worst, and that President Biden's, or former President Biden's score is 9. You were actually at 10, is that right?
10, my Gleason score was 10, yeah. So I guess that's the most aggressive you can get. It was a 10. So along with the staging, as in a stage 4, it spread to my lymph nodes, it was also very, very aggressive.
So it basically, John, could not have been worse in terms of a diagnosis to give anyone.
No. Looking back on it now, I suppose I didn't realise the magnitude of everything at the time, but having a lot more of an understanding now, it could not have been any worse. The one thing going for me was my age, in that I was young enough to for my body to withstand the surgery that I subsequently had. And it did. And as I said to you already, here I am.
Here you are. And in terms of the treatments that you've had to go through to get to where you are today, what would you say was the toughest or the one that required the most?
Without
fortitude?
A shadow of a doubt, yeah. The it's called the ADT. It's androgen deprivation treatment, hormone treatment. Prostate cancer is hormone-fueled cancer. And in order to control that, I was on ADT, which basically it's a treatment where you take the hormones out of your body. As a man, it does things to you that are not very nice, and psychologically, it's very, very difficult to deal with. You have it induces, I suppose, the equivalent of it's the andropause, which is the male, for the want of a better term, the male menopause. You've gynecomastia, which your male, the breasts, they enlarge, and the psychological impact of seeing your body transform is, I thought, very, very difficult to deal with. When I remember walking past a shopfront window at one stage, and I saw a reflection of myself, and it really hit me. That's what I look like. It's one thing seeing the world through your own eyes, which I do, but I didn't see myself. But on that reflection in a shopfront window, I saw myself, and I didn't like what I saw. And a lot of it had to do with the treatment that I was on. So then, I suppose, when I started talking about how I felt and how I deal with this, I started talking about my body. And when people look at me, they might see an overweight guy, middle-aged guy that's not very active or whatever. I actually am active, but I find it very hard to control my weight because of the treatment that I was on. So I talk to people and I say, well, this is one of the reasons why. I could be more active, yes, but this is one of the reasons why. And that was a very difficult thing for me to openly acknowledge, but also one of, in terms of private moments and my own thoughts, it was something that was very difficult for me to deal with. Because when life shuts itself out at night, you go to bed or whatever, you're alone with your own thoughts and think, oh God, I look like that. And that was very, very difficult for me to deal with. I'm still dealing with it, but a lot better than I did in the past. I am who I am, and I'm proud of who I am. I'm proud of the person and the physique that I have. I'm alive, and I'm getting to savour each and every day. I'll get to savour the rest of my life. There's a lot more people that aren't as fortunate as I. So that's only a small little thing that I have to deal with. But in terms of what I have had to deal with over the years, it's certainly the one that has had the most impact on me.
So the thing for you is, and I want to bring in, I've got Ger waiting there, and I'll go to you in a second, Ger. But this idea of getting a terminal cancer diagnosis or a terminal diagnosis from any illness, it has to completely, completely alter how you view time and how you view everything.
Yeah, Yeah, it does, and it's there's been different chapters to this. When you're told initially that your diagnosis is terminal, you don't really believe it, and it's just a word, and then it starts to sink in. I think, oh dear, this is it. This is life. I'm not going to be able to grow old and enjoy family, grandchildren, retirement, whatever the case may be. And then there was a form of acceptance eventually. Okay, well, there's nothing I can do to change it, so might as well make the most of what I have when I have it. So I was at peace with the whole thing. Whenever it was going to happen, it was going to happen. And then it didn't happen. And then, as I said to you, you have to readjust again. But that word terminal for me is a word that sometimes is misunderstood in that. But as we get a greater understanding of the disease itself, you know, whilst technically you can say it's incurable, there are many, many of us out there living very, very productive and happy lives with that tag. Okay. And it shouldn't define who we are.
No, no. And John, will you hang on? I want to bring Ger in. Ger, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you doing?
I'm sure you can relate to so much of what John was saying there about, you know, what a diagnosis like that could do to somebody.
Indeed, indeed. John had a very poor diagnosis. From my side, I had at least a score of 8, so I was 2 below and 1 below Joe Biden. But thankfully, my prostate cancer was contained. But just for any man in the country, everyone gets a diagnosis. Treatments work differently with everyone. As John said himself, the treatments he had, and he went off to find treatments to suit his condition. And that's brilliant. I can work with his concerns with ADT because in my case, I had a little hanguinate thrown in while I was being tested, etc., for prostate cancer. I had a bit of a heart event, which stopped everything. So I was actually diagnosed in 2017 off an MRI 6 weeks and 1 day after my heart event. And it was confirmed, yes, 99% positive that you have prostate cancer. So science moves on, as John says, and today they're trying to introduce MRIs more openly. And
Ger, sorry to cut across you, Ger, but would you have had symptoms at that stage that you were ignoring?
No, I had no symptoms, none whatsoever. I had been taking blood tests since I was 40 years of age through my GP, Gerard Murphy, here in Whitecourt, in Fernand in Cork, and everything was perfect. I was having another test, which is called a DRE, which again is an examination of prostate, and everything was normal, or so we thought. But as I say, it was nearly 20 years later when my PSA, which is the blood test, was rising, and I was referred into a rapid access clinic. So,
And you were young as well, Ger. You were younger than where people would have gone actively wondering about this kind of a diagnosis.
Yeah, I was older than John. Now, John would be one of the younger age men that I'm aware of who was diagnosed with prostate cancer. But I was in my late 50s, very early 60s, which is considered young for prostate cancer, as you see with Joe Biden. His age profile would be common enough. The nature of prostate cancer seems to show out in later life. It was known as an older man's disease. However, things are changing and this is affecting younger men for some reason which has not been identified yet.
And I know you know more about this than even somebody who's survived it, Ger, because you give advice to people with the as a volunteer with the Irish Cancer Support Society.
I do. When I was diagnosed, my urologist gave me a book on it and I headed down to the Daffodil Centre in the Cork University Hospital and I said, give me information. I don't want to talk to you, I want information. I need to know about this. Went home, read it, came back the following week when I had another appointment with the urologist and I said, right, now I need to talk to somebody because one of the leaflets I picked up was a peer-to-peer support. So the team on duty of the day said, right, leave it with us, took some details from me and said, somebody will ring you within 3 days, and they did. And I had a conversation with the man who had the treatment that was being proposed for me. I felt a lot better after that conversation. And then after I'd finished all my treatments and that, and after a certain period of time, I actually became a peer-to-peer support person with Irish Cancer Society. It's a phenomenal support. And as John said, you know, you get hit with your gut with all sorts of things, and different people handle it differently, but you kind of close down. And you need to talk to somebody. And the person who has had it, yes, we have the medics who are brilliant, can tell us all about the medicine side of things and the support teams that are there. But a person who has had it, I found, yeah, this person told me what he was like 10 years after he'd had his treatment. That's what I wanted to know. And today I'm 8 years post-treatment, starting post-treatment. So I'm 8 years after now. And I knew what this man told me. And yes, I can say yes, what he told me was correct.
Ger, will you hang on? And John, please hang on. I want to bring in Eugene. Eugene, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Eugene, I understand you have got a very recent diagnosis of prostate cancer.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm sort of, firstly, gaining a lot of comfort from the discussions from the two prior speakers. Because when you're in the process of getting the information, like last year, I went in, I have blood tests done regularly due to my heart being checked, and the PSA started to become elevated, only marginally, slightly above 4. But there was the second test, and that then led to being referred into the rapid access. That then led to a DRE. Again, the DRE was, oh, there's a small nodule, nothing to worry about, but let's do an MRI. Took an MRI in December, and the MRI results came back in towards the end of January, indicating a PI-RAD4, which is some of the, you get a lot of acronyms, a lot of things thrown at you again, as the speakers have said. Yeah. And that seemed to indicate a high likelihood of cancer. So then underwent a TP biopsy, the transperineum biopsy in April. And that came back with a high-grade cancer, you know, the same one, Gleason grade 5, Gleason group 5, score 9, so a 4 plus 5. And the next steps will be, we're currently in Malta, so we're returning for a PET scan, you know, which is to check if it has spread or if it's localized, and then for treatment to be decided from then. More than likely, a tentative robotic prostatectomy seems to be the path to take. I'm currently 66, so I've been tested regularly. No symptoms. It was really from the blood test in August last year to now. And I think I wanted to just mention to the speakers that when you get the diagnosis, yeah, you get the shock, the big C word, and you go to Dr. Google, as much as everyone says don't, and I would be on the ones of don't. You know, you read all the stuff, it's all the wrong things. They may be right, but not for the person who's been diagnosed. So you have to listen to the cancer support, you have to listen to your friends. And then I find it really hard for, like, my wife and family. Like, she thinks it's really unfair. Her mum died of breast cancer, so she takes it really hard. And there's a lot of support that we who are diagnosed need to consider for our closer family. And I just wanted sort of to share that, hearing these other speakers share those words while I'm on that journey. The first words I heard were 2017 and clear, now is 25. And that was, okay, that's great, because immediately you hear the word, you start thinking, how long have I got? And you've got to enjoy life, which was a good part. I mean, I do meditation. I've taken that up. I actually returned to going to the church just for the peace and solidity to think about other people, not just myself. And that helped bring comfort in. And I just wanted to share that with the audience and the speakers.
Eugene, thanks so much for getting in touch. Am I right in, from what you've said there? Like, we're talking, you've only had this news confirmed in the last 2 or 3 weeks, is it?
That's right, yeah.
And you haven't had the PET scan yet, so you still don't know if it has gone beyond the prostate.
That's right. So, like, the initial MRI comes back, the biopsy comes back with the different nodules, the 6 nodules in a prostate, and they have different grades. So not all of them have got, you know, this grading, but one side does have it with this aggressive or high-risk version that has been identified. And now the consultant is keen to confirm that it hasn't spread, you know, or if it has, is it regional or is it far-reaching? As I say, I have no symptoms. I mean, maybe some slightly increased urination at the start of the year, but there's no symptoms of this. And you sort of question the results. You sort of say, is it true? You know, but all of the factors you've got to go with that it is true. So the hope is that it is localized, and the best treatment, therefore, is surgery, the robotic surgery, to take it out, quicker recovery time. But there are alternatives. And again, I'm listening to that from the other speakers, that there are alternatives. And, you know, it's not a death sentence, even though it is obviously cancer that needs to be mentally handled.
You sound remarkably matter of fact. Eugene, would that be your way anyway to deal with things?
Yeah, I'm a little bit. I mean, I sort of work in technology, architectural technology type mind, like, which is why I went to Dr. Google research down all the levels, right down to reading about medical reports, even though that's not my background. But you know, you have to take on something. You know, I play a lot of sports and golf and tennis. You've got to accept the challenge rather than hide in a corner. So that's why I'm really coming forward, you know, for the speakers and for the audience. That when you hear this, it's not something to bottle up. It's something to approach as composed as you can. I might sound composed, but internally, the stomach goes into knots. I really struggled with sleep for the first 2 weeks when you heard this. But now I'm okay. I'm sleeping, and sleeping helps because I feel that there is support and there is a way to handle this. And ultimately, you're going to die anyway. You know, you don't have to die of this. You know, but you know, it also allows you to look at that aspect of that stage of life.
Yeah, and you raise a very important point about your wife, that we do obviously, for good reason, concentrate on the person with the diagnosis. But in many cases, it's the people immediately around them that need just as much support, and sometimes maybe even more.
Yeah. I think that's something that maybe some aspect can be covered in some of the discussions, because. I know she's not sleep. She's now not sleeping. I mean, she's very worried. She's actually out at physio at the moment. You know, she would really struggle, you know, with the unfairness of it, and you know, what's going to happen in the life. And you know, we're recently become grandparents. What things are you going to miss? All of the bad stuff goes through the head first. I think that's how the human mind is wired. And you know, you really have to live in the present, and you have to think about, you know. How I'd probably like some guidance from anyone, or any experiences from some maybe your other speakers, about how they dealt with this for their wife and close family in terms of discussing and help.
Yeah. OK, we might come to that in a moment. I need to take a break, but stay there. We'll have more calls on this after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
We're getting a lot of calls on this. Sean, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was actually diagnosed with prostate cancer like on the 29th of January 2024. But I'll go back to prior to all this. I'll just let you in on something like to all your listeners. On the October of previous, I was I did get my bloods checked every 6 months, and I had a normal PSA level. For all the years I've had, so a normal PSA level, you like to call it the word, was 1.5. It was normal for my age and whatever. And what happened then was, I was going up to the doctor, I was getting a little skin tag taken off my skin and getting that checked. But in a couple of weeks later to that, blood appeared in my urine. And I just said, oh, maybe that's something happened there. And I said, I'll leave it. And then the following week again, Friday after that, it appeared again. So this time I said, I'm going to the doctor. I'm going to ask what's behind this. So I went to the doctor anyway, and she took me blood, and I took the urine sample, and look, and there was blood, a trace of blood. I couldn't see it, but there was a trace of blood in the sample, in the test.
Mm-hmm.
And then what she did then was she said, I'll have to send you to the Bond Secure to refer you to a urologist. And referred me to this urologist in Bond Secure. He was very good, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to get a test done, and one thing after another, various tests. I had to get biopsies done, I got MRIs done, CAT scans, everything, you name it. And then he came back to me at one of the stages and he said, have you got prostate cancer? I smelled a rat somewhere along the line. He said, like, is there prostate cancer in your family at any stage? Now, I couldn't recollect any of it. Like, probably my mum's brother or something, but that was nothing to do with it anyway. But in the meantime, anyway, we'd often got the biopsies done. When the biopsies came back, and it had, he said it was an aggressive form of cancer. I had, it was at least a 9, was 6 cores on the left side of my prostate, had at least a 9, and 1 core on the right side had at least a 7. And plus in the tissues, like I say, for argument's sake, it'd be like a mandarin orange. It's like the skin on the inside of the orange, like, had, that's what we call the tissue. It was in that, was cancer in that also.
Sean, that was January of last year. And
yeah, January of 24, yeah.
And you got radiation therapy for that?
I tell you what happened then was, first of all, I went to put me, I went to 2 different guys. I went to a surgeon consultant and a radiation consultant. So they went through the 2. Mm-hmm. So when I went to the operation consultant, he said he could not operate on me. The reason being was it was too near to the pelvic wall of my prostate. It was too much to the outside. Mm-hmm. He said I could not open you up there. He says it was too dangerous. It wouldn't be feasible, because he said the thing, he couldn't guarantee. I think it would spread everywhere. You know what I mean? That's basically what he said. So he referred me then back to another guy which does the hormone treatment plus the radiologist guy.
And that's the road you ended up going down, radiotherapy and then the hormone treatment for a number of months.
And the hormone, the hormone treatment. I get an injection every 3 months, and then they put me on this special tablet as well. It's called abiraterone. It's used in people with metastasis cancer, like, as well. So you put me on that, to see would that work and keep it at bay. It's more or less to keep it at bay. It'll never be cured, I was told, but it was just to keep it at bay.
And how are you now, Sean?
Feeling good, actually. I play golf. I do everything for... I just feel great myself, you know what I mean? I'm a positive person in general anyway. I had to take it on the head, and my whole life sort of changed around somewhat, but I just keep doing everything as much as I can and be positive as much as I can and just carry on as normal as much as I can. Now, that's as much as I say, but I had my moments, had times. You know what I mean? Like, and it was a hard, me wife as well, we couldn't believe this was happening, really, you know? So it's one of those things in life. So you just adapt, you know?
What age are you, John, or Sean, roughly?
I'm 66 now. I was retired there from my job there a couple of weeks ago. So I'm retired now.
So God, young as well. Yeah, I mean, so many, you know, people do associate this with older men, but actually, you know, all the people we've been talking to were young men, really. To have to deal with this, you know.
Yeah, but the mind-boggling thing is, for me, was the normal PSA level, which you're doing a normal test. That was the... Have I never seen that blood? That blood never... I'm going to tell you something. I went up and got another test later on after that again, and there was no trace of blood to be found in the urine. You know what I mean?
So that's really why you wanted to ring in, Sean, to tell people that just because you have the normal PSA, you need to look out for other symptoms like that. And as you say, it was finding that blood that actually saved you.
It did. The finding the blood saved me, but the fact was, I was going to the toilet a little bit more regularly as well at night, like, not realising, you know what I mean? That's the other part as well people have to be aware of. Like, if you feel like you're going more regularly at night, like, they say they should go and get the exam, like, it's the they call it the finger test, really. Basically, that's what should be done, you know what I mean? I think, you know, and that doesn't mean anything either. It's just one of those things that can happen. I was just lucky, I tell you that much now. I was just lucky.
It's a great way to look at it, Sean, that you were lucky because you did catch it and you did get the right treatment at the right time. The very, very best of luck to you going forward with that, Sean. And thank you for that. And it's an important one to remember that You know, don't, just because your PSA results keep coming back normal doesn't mean there isn't something going on. Ross, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Katie. How are you doing?
God, we were just saying there, people being diagnosed, getting this diagnosis very young. You were very, very young.
Yeah, 40, just about to turn 41, and found out pretty much by accident. I was on a dive trip in Thailand and had a scooter accident, and I was living in Melbourne back then, and I got back to Melbourne, went to see my GP to make sure all the cuts and bruises were okay, like I wasn't infected from the accident, and he found a little skin cancer similar to what Sean was talking about, I think, there a moment ago. Mm-hmm. And while he was dealing with that, I brought up the subject of family history of prostate cancer. My GP did a blood test. He said, look, we won't do the digital exam just yet. Let's just run some blood. You're 40. It's a good time to start. And then a week later, I got a call. It was, you need to come in. It was a significant problem. My PSA was through the roof. And, I rapidly went to a diagnosis of advanced prostate cancer. So, yeah, within weeks, it was time to take the prostate out.
Wow, so that was a fairly extreme version of a diagnosis that you might be expecting to get. And how did you react to that initially? Like, cause coming out of the blue, I mean, as you say, you weren't even feeling unwell at all. It was just you were getting treated for a scooter accident.
I actually had to make a second appointment and go back and see my GP 2 days later. I was like, you need to tell me all of that again, because I know what you said, but I don't understand how it's going to impact me. So he went through the process and told me that, you know, you need to have a biopsy. Then if it's there, we'll refer you to a urologist, surgeon and radiologist, and you will be given a range of options. This happened within a couple of weeks. And as soon as they got the scans back and they got the biopsy back, it was like, this has to come out. This is very severe. The tumour that I had inside my prostate was 12 cubic centimetres. And I believe, if I remember right, a healthy prostate is about 7 cubic centimetres.
So it was bigger than a healthy prostate, the actual tumour itself.
Yeah, but it was still contained within what was left of the prostate. So, it was a pretty rapid progression surgery to get it out.
Ross, did you have symptoms with that level of a tumour?
So, I now know I did. As I was talking to your producers before coming on, many of what I thought were symptoms of maybe partying a bit too hard when I was younger turned out to be symptoms of prostate cancer. And the previous caller, I think it was Sean, was the previous caller?
Sean, yeah.
Was talking about the frequency of urination at night. I had, you know, the dribbling a bit of urine after going to the bathroom, like, you know, moments or minutes afterwards. These were things that I just thought, well, you were a bit of a heavy beer drinker back in the day, and this could be your body's way of saying you went a bit too hard. As soon as my doctor talked to me about them, I was like, oh, yeah, that's me. And, realised that I'd had symptoms for a number of years. So when they got the when they removed the prostate and they did, I think it's called a histology, I don't remember the right term. They basically said, based on the size of the growth, they reckoned I'd probably have it anywhere between 4 and 7 years, and I was still 40 at the time.
Right. So you got it early in your 30s. Wow.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah. So. But the upside of that is that was 11 years ago, and I'm still here. Even though the diagnosis has progressed to metastatic, I continue to have treatment, continue to have scans. And like John, the first caller that I heard, the chap you were interviewing, reducing it to tears, because one of the treatments he talked about was the androgen deprivation treatment, and that has been the most impactful of any of them to me, and I haven't cried for quite a long time, but
John was very clear that of all of what he had gone through, the treatment that took the most fortitude was that hormone treatment. Yeah, because it basically takes all the male hormones out of your body.
Pretty much, yeah. And you to say menopausal is the closest sort of description. It really is. I went through everything from the hot flushes to not being able to sleep. Not being able to keep a train of thought, and I had 3 years of that treatment. It nearly drove me absolutely insane. The upside is I wouldn't be alive without it. So,
Were you able to come off it voluntarily yourself, or how were you able to move on from it?
Well, I was very fortunate. I got accepted into a study for an advanced radiation therapy treatment in Melbourne, and they took me off the androgen deprivation in order to start that process. Now, that was a very successful treatment. I had a small bunch of a little cluster of tumours in my chest from the lymph node metastasizing, and it got things under control. My PSA has been slightly climbing again in the last year, so it's likely I'm going to have to go back on it again to try and keep that, keep it at bay, as John said, because it's now just a case of for however long you continue to put out fires, we'll put out fires with whatever measure is available to me, and that, if it means the androgen deprivation again, well, so be it.
I wish you the very best with that, Ross. I'm sure you wouldn't. You don't relish that prospect again, but as you say, what needs most.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I would just say, as a sort of finishing note, if there are any guy out there, no matter what your age, if you have any concerns, speak to your doctor. Because, I had symptoms without knowing I had symptoms. So if anybody has concerns that things aren't functioning correctly, go and have a chat with your GP.
Yeah. Ross, thanks so much and the very best of luck with all of that now.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Cheers.
Ross.
Have a good day.
Take care.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we've been talking about prostate cancer diagnosis and treatment and people's responses to that in the wake of that news about former President Biden's diagnosis last night. Pather, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you.
Yeah, Pather, you've been down this road.
I have been down this road, and I would just listen to the previous gentleman, and I really did get off lightly. I was notified in 2020, just at the start of COVID, Father, you have prostate cancer. And I said, flipping hell. And all the cars, I'm a complete petrol head, and all the cars I have to rebuild. So the doctor took me in hand and sent me to Dublin, looked at me and said, you have to go for radiation treatment. And went into Limerick for 26 days. And they brought me from 30 down to -3. And now I'm one of the older ones. I'm clocking 81 this year. And I have never looked back. Right, there is certain things that are not as good as they were. And we won't go into that. But I would recommend anybody from my age, from younger, as those gentlemen were on, to get treatment for it if they have the prostate cancer. Now, I can say I'm 100%.
It does sound like you were very lucky that the treatment was short effective.
It's very effective. My doctors, they still monitor me, but thank God I'm doing the normal things, out walking, cycling, whatever, you name it, I'm doing it, and 100%. And to listen to the previous gentleman, I got off so light. And I've been notified in time.
When you say, Pather, from 30 down to 3, what numbers are we talking about there?
What the doctor told me is you're up, going up on 30. Now, I didn't even ask the question. I never asked the doctor any question. You're the boss, I'd say, you tell me what to do. Now, I asked him recently because I go back periodically, and he said, you're down to 0.3. In other words, you're back to normal. Now, I hadn't to go for operations, hadn't to go for anything, only the radiation treatment that they gave me in Limerick, which was fantastic.
And
I have just to say it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Sorry, Pather. I was just going to say, I mean, you have a great way about you. I was just, did it knock you for six when you got the news first? Like, when you heard the cancer word?
It did, because you have a family, you have grandchildren, you have great-grandchildren. And gee, I said, this is it, clock out time. But I went to the doctor and he sat down with me and explained to me, in Limerick, they sat down with me, gave me the literature to look, to read on, and I took it and read it and believed what it said. Now, as I know in time, you get literature and you only read bits and pieces of it. But I sat down and read every bit of it and I said, right, this is it, go for the treatment and see what way it works out. Now, I went for the treatment, right, from Innes into Limerick every evening, about 25 miles in and out, 50 miles, but was worth it. And the staff were brilliant, you know, looking after me inside.
Pather, thanks a million. And I'm delighted to hear your story. And it'll give people, again, a lot of hope out there, because I'm just so conscious of people who might be worrying about it, might have a doctor's appointment coming up or might have got that first diagnosis. It's great to hear. That
correct.
But I'm
just saying that the younger people, because I've said it to younger people when I meet them, go for it. Now, I was, 75, 76 when I went for it. And I thought this is clock out time. But now, thank God, nearly 100% in that department, like working away as a normal day, walking, cycling, you name it, I'm doing it. And I would recommend every younger person wants to reach a certain age, go to your doctor, get checked for it. And you know, you're in or you're out with it.
Yeah, get checked. That's the big one
that
for today.
That is the main thing.
Pather, thanks so much. I'll bring in Jerry now. Jerry, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
Very well, Jerry. So you've been down this road and you've written about it.
Well, I only wrote about it because the number of friends that asked me how was it going, how did I get on, they said, you know what, if you were to write all that down, it would be a real help to men, because men are so thick and stupid that, and I take that on the chin, that, you know, they don't talk to each other about stuff. I have a wife and two daughters, and I know women talk to each other. If there's something out there for women, they're bound to know about it, because someone in the company or the group or the community will say, guess what, I know about that. Whereas men kind of keep to themselves. They think it's a macho thing to bottle it up and to be going around talking about their issues. They wouldn't like it, especially when it can lead to issues like incontinence and ED. So I think really that even stops young men from going to the doctor, because some people would nearly prefer to be dead than have continence issues or erectile function issues, right? Mm-hmm. So what I'd be saying to them is, today, if they were bombarded with scores and counts and square metres and cubic centimetres and all that, forget all that. Just go down to the doctor and the doctor will take it from there. I had a charmed run through this because my wife is a nurse, and I kind of never Googled because I don't think she'd let me anyway. And second of all, she's the one that hunted me out every year to get my bloods done. And when COVID came, there was a year and a half whereby I couldn't get out. You weren't welcome into the clinics anywhere, the dispensaries. So when it was over, she said, off you go again. And when I did, to my surprise, I got a different phone call. Your PSA count is high. So what happens? We'll do it again. And it was just taken from there. And if I fast forward to having made the decision eventually to go for a prostatectomy, when I got the results back from the lab on that removed organ, I had 25% of it cancerous. But guess what? It was all contained within the organ. Now, that was great news. Mm-hmm. But what was worrying news is if it grew 25% in that elongated year when we couldn't go there because of COVID. What would it have done if I gave it 2 or 3 years? You know, probably being gone outside the prostate and touching other organs, and, you know, the spine is very close as well. So I'd absolutely be saying, don't be afraid. And then issues beyond that, continence and erectile dysfunction, it can be dealt with in some instances. I know I can only speak for my own story, and I know some of the stories you heard today were far more harrowing than mine. I feel I had a charmed run, like the last petrol head said there.
The issue that you bring it up there, and it's a very personal issue for a lot of people, anything to do with continence issues and absolutely anything to do with erectile dysfunction is obviously hugely personal. And I think a lot of fear around it, as you say, because there isn't, people don't talk about it, or men don't talk to each other about it.
They don't, but I have to say, I don't know how many names now on my phone from people who felt, once they knew I had that book out there, that they could ring me up and talk to me about any aspect of any of those things, and they have done. And one of the things I'd like to emphasise as well, there's a kind of a culture in Ireland that says, Errol, what's wrong with that fella at his age? It's down his knees, he should be praying for a happy death, not worrying about intimacy issues in the bedroom or something like that. But that's not the case, and I can tell you why. I had several gentlemen on to me and telling me their story. Some were very angry that they were never told that they'd end up like this after a prostatectomy. Now, I would actually put a different colour on that.
Were you saying that these were men of a certain age?
Well, I'll tell you what age. 82, for example, was one. One was 82. And I was delighted. And I said, fair play to you. And I say fair play to every man. That it's your expectation that needs to be noted by your surgeon. And later on, one of the prostate cancer patients, sent me a podcast that was excellent. And in that podcast, this man is a sexual therapist, and he said, you, when asked how is sexual function at the moment, you should tell him really how good it is and how good you expect it to be. I'll never forget being asked that question myself when he did say, how is erectile function at the moment? Well, I said, in hurling parlance, I said, I'm playing senior hurling and sometimes attaining a 3 in a row. Now, he was a sporting surgeon as well, so he both got the message and he got the humour in that. But when he walked into my ward the day after my prostatectomy, the first line he said to me was, your surgery went well and I have phoned your wife and told her so. The second line he said was, and I did nerve sparing. Now, I'd like the people who are fearful out there to know that nerve sparing means it's like a Cat7 wire, I suppose, for the telephone or whatever. He was able to spare as many nerves as he could to give me hope of playing senior hurling again, shall we say, you know, in terms of erectile function.
I actually haven't called that before, Jerry. But well, carry on. I think we all know the space we're in here. Yeah.
You do, you know the space, and especially after the weekend we've had. So, in hurling. So, what I would say is that he was telling me the truth. The reason he bothered to save nerves was because of the conversation we had had. There is a form that gets filled out, and other unfortunate men that phoned me up, I said, well, what did you put down on that form? To tell you the truth, we didn't fill that in at all. You know, out of shyness or whatever. But, you know, there's no point in being shy about things like that. I would go back to stress having somebody, the man who said he never was told that, I think they warn you about everything, but it's very hard to hear the things that they're saying to you about your own body when you're in a state of crisis like this. So having a second person in, whether it's a friend, a partner, whomever, I think it's a wonderful idea because they can clearly hear what's being said, maybe even take a note of it. Now, I suggested that to guys who contacted me as well, and they said, well, there's no so-and-so way I'm taking anybody in there, and certainly not my wife anyway, you know. But, I mean, I think they're at a loss. So I was so charmed to have the kind of nursing wife support all the way along. And when it came to continence, another issue people shy away from, a wonderful physiotherapist that was able to introduce me to my pelvic floor, and a lot of people now are saying, what's that? But it is an alternative muscle for controlling the flow of urine. I honestly didn't know I had one, right?
Well, I'll tell you, a lot of middle-aged women know they have pelvic floors, or they don't have much pelvic floor left, Jerry, that is for sure. But yes, I would say it's not something that men are as familiar with.
And because of that, 'twas a middle-aged woman, I asked, what pelvic floor therapist did you go to? And when I contacted her, she said she didn't do men. It's harder to get one for men, apparently. But I did, eventually, and being excellent. Once I went through the exercises with her, and, you know, it comes to a stage where she says, OK, now, if you can go 3 nights without a pad, for example, call a pad, she said you're off pads forever at night, OK? And that's a wonderful step forward, great progress in that. One of the things I wasn't aware to, I just kept taking it, but the surgeon would put you on a light dose of Cilindafil, which is like Viagra, another name, I think. A light dose of that, once you come straight out of the operation for weeks and weeks and weeks. And the idea of that is to keep blood flow to the certain organ, so that in time, if you want to, enrich that with Viagra or whatever, you have something to work on, as opposed to having something without circulation. So it's very well planned in what you can have, but the patient's expectation must be to the fore as well. And they don't have to know counts or scores or anything like that. It's just to come forward with an honest, say, story to the surgeon of how life is and how you want it to be. And I think then the surgeon taking that on board will work with you. And, you know, people were fairly direct with me. They said, how's the cancer going? I said, prostate cancer is gone. How's the piddling going? Well, that's under control now, thanks be to God. I'm back cycling, playing golf, gardening, etc. And how's the passion going? Wink, wink. Well, that's a longer journey. It's like a journey like from Cork to Belfast. And I think at the time of writing, I was only as far as Dublin or Galway. I might have gone astray. But yeah, look, I've been to Belfast anyway, with a nudge from our good old friend that we joke about all the time. So it has a great place in our life, thanks to Pfizer. And, you know, I think people need to talk to each other to be able to get candid information. And not be like the juveniles we were going through puberty. One fella boasted that he was better than the next, and none of us knowing anything, if you know what I mean. I think we should be better in our 60s and 50s. There's one other thing to say to people who might be shy of getting tested for prostate cancer. You could have a prostate issue and it's totally benign. So there's the prostate squeezing on your piddle pipe, and the doctor, the surgeon, will core that out and say to you, come back in 5 or 10 years' time. So you haven't cancer at all. It's quite a physical issue where the prostate is just choking and you're in pain for the want of being able to piddle, and you can't, you know, or you can't stop piddling, or it's hard to start. So some of those things are actually benign prostate issues that won't warrant any treatments down the road at all.
Right. So we've seen your hurling and piddle pipes, Jerry.
Straight talking.
Straight talking, absolutely, and very grateful we are for. Will you hang on, Jerry? And we'll have to take a break, and we'll come back with more after these.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Can I bring in Peter now? Peter, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
Your diagnosis was 10 years ago now. Is that right?
It was. I just went along to my doctor whether it was an annual or whatever, a series of blood tests for no particular reason. And he came back and he said, the PSA is 6. And he said a year ago at that stage, they wouldn't have bothered with that. But he says now they're saying 6 is an indicator that there could be a problem. So I said, fine. So he sent me on the rapid prostate checking in a hospital in Dublin, and I had a biopsy, and there was a sign of it, certainly. Now, I haven't, at this stage, I have no idea of percentages or whatever, where we're at, but I did have it. There were various options. There was the radium treatment or brachytherapy, which is putting little bits of nuclear pins or whatever, not quite, but seeds around the prostate and try to get it off. Now, for some reason, I wasn't eligible for that. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. But the other thing was robotic surgery. And, you know, because it was cancer, I said, not interested in anything else, but just get it out. That was my first thought. And I went along, saw a guy, and he did it a few weeks later. And I had a catheter in for about a week while it all healed up. And I really have to say I haven't looked back. I have the PSA checked. I don't know whether it's even necessary now, but I have it checked every year, and it just comes back undetectable, which means it ain't there. So, I'm 75, so fellas of my age, we have a little pee problem at times, but nothing I can't live with. I mean, it's just wonderful. So,
and was that was it? Yeah. It was literally just that one surgical visit to the hospital, and that was it?
That was it. 2 days later, I was out. Beautiful. I mean, a wonderful job. Great. There are other ones, but this was the most advanced. And I don't know how long it was. I mean, normally, seemingly, according to my doctor, if I wanted to have the robotic job done, I would have had to go to Germany before this. Whereas this person, I don't know whether others were doing it at that stage, but this guy was doing it in Dublin. And, okay, my doctor really didn't have an idea of what his experience was. So I asked him at the time, you know, when I saw him, and he said, I've done about 1,000. So that was good enough for me. And it is very, I mean, it's not invasive in any sense. On my tummy, I've got a few darker little marks, I think 5, where they go in with various bits of their equipment and a camera. And that's it. And really, I mean, I have to say, I haven't looked back. And I just, the idea of going for the radiation treatment, the idea of going into a hospital for, I think at that stage, it was 7 weeks every day or 5 days a week. I just couldn't hack that. So I said, and the fact that it was cancer, I said, get out. And when we got the letter from the consultant, he said that the margins were clear. In other words, it hadn't escaped. And that was the best news I've ever had.
Were you warned at that stage that you might have, you know, some
incontinent?
Well, the side effects that we were talking to Jerry about there.
Yeah. I mean, he was brilliant. What he was saying. Yes, I was. I mean, as they say about every surgery, you might not survive this, all this sort of stuff. But the alternative just it had to go. With regard to erections or whatever, let's put it that way, you lose that facility, there's no doubt. But you will get it back. When I say, well, I got it back. I'm 75 now. But I got it back after a few years because they do the nerve saving or sparing or whatever it's called. They do that as a matter of course, and certainly this man did.
And again, what Jerry was saying there, it was important to have that conversation before your surgery about how this would be an important thing for you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is made very clear. But in my case, and I can't speak for anybody else, and listening to some of the guys and the age that they had it was ghastly for them. The word cancer was enough. I just hate that word. And anything to make sure that was gone was the most important thing to me. There's no question. Everything else is secondary, as far as I was concerned. Yeah. But as I said, everybody else is different. But I would, I mean, it was pure chance, and it was just my own doctor, who I have absolute faith in, saying that, it, you know, at 6, it is on the margins. So, we're going to have to go and get it checked. And I was just delighted. But as I said, a year prior to that, he wouldn't have bothered because, that 6 was acceptable. Maybe it was 7 or 8. I mean, I was. That's the highest I was ever. And then, as I said, it's non-detectable now, which is presumably is gone.
Okay, Peter. Great story. Great to hear it. And so much luck involved. It strikes you when you talk to all of these cases. Thanks for that, Peter. And Jerry, I let you go as well now.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we're going to finish up on something completely different. I've got Tom on the line. Tom, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
I'm very well, Tom. Tom, tell us, what did you get your son, Harry, for his 10th birthday?
I gifted him a membership for Liverpool Football Club for the 24-25 season.
And did the you know, did you go into the raffle for the mascot at that stage, or how did that work?
There was different perks, obviously, with the membership there, where he got a birthday card and a little Liverpool goodie bag, and updates on email and stuff like that. And in the small print, there was things like that, where you could possibly meet a player or attend training sessions or potentially be a mascot. But I kind of ignored all the small print for obvious reasons.
Right. Tom, you wouldn't turn, if you radio on in the background there, you might get somebody to turn it off, or it's just a slight interference.
Yeah, sorry for that.
So there was small print to say that you could end up in this draw to be a mascot. But I mean, we're talking about maybe what? Definitely hundreds of thousands, if not more than that, would go into
definitely.
That draw.
Yeah, definitely, of course, because even when you look at his membership number is very high. I took the small perks on board, but definitely never thought that his name would ever be called out to be a mascot for the Liverpool Football Club. So we're ecstatic is an understatement.
Because, yeah, you got the message. How were you told? How did the news come through?
We received an email. I was on my way home from work one day, and I was on the road leaving West Clare, and I looked at the phone, and it was only my personal email address. So I put that phone to one side, and I said, it can't be too important. And when it beeped again the second time, I pulled over on the side of the road and checked, and noticed that it was from Liverpool Football Club, and the initial headline was that Harry was randomly picked to be the Liverpool mascot for the game against Brighton in the American Express Stadium.
So that is this weekend coming up?
That's right, it's tonight, so the game is 8 o'clock tonight.
Oh, it's tonight, oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay, is Harry there with you, Tom?
He's right beside me.
Would you put him on for a minute?
I will, of course.
Hello.
Harry, congratulations.
Thanks.
Tell me, who are you most excited to meet tonight?
Van Dijk and Mo Salah.
Oh yeah, Mo Salah. Do you have any idea yet? Who you walk out holding one of the players' hands, don't you?
Yeah, Van Dijk.
Oh, you know now it's Van Dijk. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Were you thrilled when you heard?
What?
Were you thrilled when you heard it was going to be Van Dijk?
Yeah.
How long have you been a Liverpool fan, Harry?
I think when I was a little baby.
Before you were able to walk?
Yeah, probably.
And tell me, as an Irish man, Harry, you must be a fan of the keeper as well, are you?
Yeah.
Because obviously we're all proud of Caoimhín Kelleher.
Yeah.
What's the part of tonight that you are most excited about?
Walking out on the pitch.
Can you believe that it's actually happening? That it's going to happen?
Yeah.
Have you slept at all for the last week?
What?
Did you sleep at all for the last week thinking about it?
Yeah, I have.
Right. You're a cool customer.
Yeah.
Are you nervous? Are you nervous at all?
Not really. I'm excited.
Well, listen, Harry, you have a fantastic time. I'm going to have to tune in and watch you coming out. You enjoy every minute of it, okay?
Yeah.
Okay. That is a cool customer, I think we can say. Harry Fleming there from Castlereagh, who has been chosen out of millions to be the mascot for tonight's match. Okay, that's it for today. Ruth Kennington was on sound. Owen McLaughlin produced.